From the Sky News Centre at 5, two boys aged 15 and 16 have been arrested following five acid attacks in London last night. A delivery rider is among the victims. Adele Bellis survived an acid attack 3 years ago.
I was on the phone, so my hand got the brunt of it, my arm, my chest, the side of my head. I lost my ear as well.
A final decision on whether Charlie Gard will be allowed to go abroad for treatment will be made by the 25th of July. The terminally ill baby's parents have been appealing for the right to do so at the High Court. Thousands of people have turned out to pay their respects at Bradley Lowry's funeral. Kevin Gover reports.
A lone piper playing Amazing Grace escorted Bradley as his coffin was taken into St Joseph's Church in Blackall.
Celebrate the life of a wonderful little boy who touched the lives of millions of people.
His mum Gemma read a poem.
For now, my baby, we'll say goodbye. We'll meet again, our superhero, high up in the sky.
The Mascot's fight against a rare form of cancer was a very public one.
Fought for so long, it really gets to you, breaks your heart.
Mourners were told Bradley had a pure and innocent love of the beautiful game.
A former TV producer has been jailed for trying to get his wealthy partner killed. David Harris made the plan so he could be with his lover. In sport, Marin Cilic is into the Wimbledon final. The second semi's now underway. Live to Richard Newman on centre court.
Yes, Cilic through to his first Wimbledon decider and at his 11th attempt. He came from a set down to beat Andy Murray's conqueror Sam Querrey in four sets. That's brought the main event onto centre. Seven-time champion Roger Federer against the former runner-up Thomas Burdick. Federer looking every inch the favourite for the title. He's broken serve and is currently serving 4-3 up in its juice.
And Manchester City have signed defender Kyle Walker from Tottenham in a deal thought to be worth more than £50 million. That's the latest. I'm Kieran Corr.
BCFM 93.2. Yes, it's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping us review this week's news as Green Councillor for Cotton Cleo Lake. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, how do the various leadership charities decide who, at the age of 16 or 18, has the potential to be a future leader? And if you're lucky enough to be selected, what are our future leaders taught on their Rhodes or Harvard scholars' bursaries? And what, if anything, do they have to reveal about themselves? Also, rumours are rife, Brexit or no Brexit, Britain's armed forces may be being integrated into the EU army anyway. We ask a former Royal Naval Commander, is there any truth to the rumours? And if so, where does that leave Brexit? Plus, the devastating new documentary series out on the History Channel, American Drug Wars. Extracts from episode one tonight as we see the CIA flexing its post-World War II muscles by joining with the Mafia to take countries over. In exchange, because that's always the way with the mob, isn't it? Joining up with the mob to monopolise global supplies of drugs. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight's lows of 15 Celsius, mainly dry. This weekend, highs of 21 Celsius. It's mainly cloudy and breezy with some drizzle tomorrow. Next week, highs of 24 Celsius, cloudier with some showers at the beginning of the week, though sunnier at the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 22nd and 23rd of July, highs of 24 Celsius roughly and sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Cottam.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for Cottam, Cleo Lake, and she'll be here along here in a minute. But Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, we've seen in the news more acid attacks today. Just heard about them on the Sky News bulletin there. It seems that there are a few tactics used being used by Al-Qaeda, and maybe this is nothing to do with all of that, but these basic racist acid attacks I suppose, what do you think? Is it more driven by Al-Qaeda or more just a kind of racism and Islamophobia?
Well, I don't really know much about these acid attacks. I did see the headlines earlier, and obviously people have been hurt. So that's about all I know, and I don't know anything about motive or anything, so it's hard to comment, really.
Okay, is that it?
Well, I don't really know what there's been. Are you suggesting that these?
Well, there's been two young, about 16-year-olds have been arrested for acid attacks. Is this a commonplace thing?
Listen, if you look at the Daily Gleaner from Jamaica, you will see that acid attacks are fairly common, and they used to be very common in Victorian Britain. So, I'm very nasty and very unpleasant. But they may or may not have political aspects to them. I'm just not aware if there is a political aspect to this.
Okay, what about the things like knife attacks, lorry attacks, van attacks, these kinds of things? Well, very easy. Anybody could do these things, couldn't they, really?
Well, they can, especially if you're going to go for soft targets of attacking people at random. And, of course, that, you know, you may well ask, well, what's the point? And, you know, we know that people, that for example, in the United States, 95% of people convicted of terrorism offences have been entrapped into those terrorism offences by the FBI. In other words, the FBI have set up various plots, recruited various patsies to be in these plots, and then arrested them and accused them of being terrorists. But, of course, they wouldn't have been terrorists if the FBI hadn't set them up. The other 5% in the US are where the terrorists end up dead. And, of course, the suspicion has to be that they also have been set up by the FBI, but they've ended up dead. So I just don't know what's happened in this case. It's quite possible, but you've got to realise that, you know, patsies can be set up. People with drug, alcohol, mental health issues can be persuaded to do stuff if people nudge them.
Now, are you
and
talking
then you
about...
can say, oh, look, we're under attack from these terrible people.
Now, it does seem, doesn't it? We'll be talking about this in the American Drug Wars from the History Channel in part two, in the second hour. But there has been this kind of obsession over the years by the American intelligence services, who, of course, took on a lot of Nazis onto their books, to set up these kind of Manchurian candidates. What are they? The idea being that you can scrub somebody's memory, scramble their brain, and then kind of program them to go out and do whatever you want.
Well, they've been trying to control people's minds for a long time, and they put a lot of effort and into it. So, for example, LSD was originally used by the CIA to try and control people's minds and so on. And then it kind of became a sort of street drug on the back of that. What we do know is that most of the people who end up dying in terrorist attacks or being set up as terrorists and then arrested do not, in fact, have the profile of serious hardcore terrorists. You know, the Guildford Four and the Birmingham Six, for example, were similarly not terrorist types. They were basically, you know, the sort of people who get into trouble with the law for their own reasons, etc. And they were, you know, beaten up by the police and fitted up for both things.
When they just picked at random on a
ferry.
Well,
they were
ferry,
they were
Irish,
and therefore picked up because they were, you know, the police were just looking
for
anybody who was
Irish. They
were
ordinary people who were just about to take a ferry to Ireland. They were Irish people.
Indeed.
But it just so happened that was that evening
after
the bombing.
If you actually look at the profile of real IRA terrorists, the ones who actually carried out the attacks, they're very, very different. The sort of people we see being touted to us as terrorist maniacs are, in fact, they're patsies, basically. Real, well-organised terrorists who know what they're doing don't look like these kind of people at all. They're very different.
Now, we're told that websites like the Free Thought Project are fake news, and no doubt there is some stories on there that aren't very well organised. We got one here called Recordings Reveal FBI Gave Man... Just hang on a second. Recordings reveal FBI man gave a rifle urged him to carry out mass shootings to defend Islam. This is on the Free Thought Project.
Yeah.
And if I just carry on reading through there, it's become a near weekly occurrence. It says, somewhere in some state, the FBI will announce they've failed yet another terrorist plot, foiled, and saved lives. However, as the data shows, the majority of these cases involve psychologically diminished patsies who've been entirely groomed, armed, and entrapped by FBI agents. Simply put, the FBI manufactures terror threats and then takes credits for stopping them. But what happens when they take it too far? What happens when the FBI actually tells someone to conduct a mass shooting? Well, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, we're seeing this unfold firsthand. About 2 years ago, Sami Mohammed Hamza, 25, found himself in the midst of an FBI sting. Little did he know, he was being groomed for terrorism by the same government who claims to fight terrorism. Now this isn't an isolated case, is it?
I'll put
a link up to this on our show page so people can check it out.
Well, in the 1993 World Trade Center bombings, it was very clear all of the principals involved in it had received visas from the US authorities, and the whole plot was actually run by the FBI, including supplying the explosives to their patsy inside the organisation that supposedly carried out the attack. And the patsy said, presumably you don't want me to use these explosives. The FBI said, no, we do want you to use the explosives. The explosives were used, 6 people were killed, and then they're all immediately arrested because the FBI have orchestrated the whole plot. This all came out in the trial.
Now, if you think about it, an acid attack is actually very simple to organise. There is actually the possibility of hypnosis too. I don't want to put ideas into people's heads, but there's lots of ways that you can actually get someone to do something stupid. They might probably think it's for some trivial reason, but they don't realise the bigger picture. Anyhow, we shall see what happens with these people who've been arrested for the acid attacks and what transpires about what influences there were on them. Anyway, I'm joined by Cleo Lake, who's at Green, councillor for Cotton. Hi, Cleo. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Hello. And first of all, can you just give us an idea of what got you interested in politics? I think you became a councillor, was it last year for the first time?
Yep, so I've just done my first year, got elected last May, and well, I suppose, you know, I think I've been on your show before talking carnival, and I was the chair at carnival for a couple of years, so that gave me a very good grounding actually to then go into politics, which really is very close to activism as far as I can see.
Well, there's a lot of politics in the carnival, isn't there? Because it hasn't happened. There's been pressure on people up in London to move Notting Hill, for example.
Yeah.
But here, we haven't actually had a carnival for a couple of years now. It's about this time of year it's supposed to be, isn't it?
That's right. It's usually the first Saturday of July. What we have had, though, is since, I mean, I left the carnival organisation in end of 2015, and that year when we couldn't deliver a carnival, we did have a grassroots event called Grassroots at the Malcolm X Centre, and that has continued. So there was a really great event this year at the Malcolm X, family entertainment, arts, culture, young people made costumes about, you know, in the month leading up. So in some ways the culture and the participation is becoming more embedded in the community again. So that is positive.
So what's happening this year? Has it already happened?
Well, the grassroots event has already happened on the traditional first Saturday of July. It was a very great event at Malcolm X, also at the Quimba Centre. So the kind of traditional areas of the African Caribbean community, very much at the centre of that, and a kind of self-funded, self-determined community grassroots action, which I welcome. And really, as I've said, when I reflect back to a few years ago at Malcolm X Centre on Carnival Day, it was kind of sometimes you had techno playing and, you know, that kind of revelry. So I'm very happy to see that the Malcolm X is collaborating with SPAC, St Paul's African Caribbean Carnival, to create something that is more in line with the ethos of the African Caribbean community and friends.
It does feel a little bit like one of those cartoons where someone is kind of disappearing off into the horizon, you get another look somewhere else and they're disappearing still. We keep being told, oh, it'll be back next year,
I mean, well, who knows? I mean, I think what will definitely happen next year is a continuation of what has happened in the years it's been officially off. And I think nobody, especially people in the community who are very passionate about it, shouldn't leave anything to chance. So they should be making their plans, making their costumes and building towards their best 50th. Which, you know, I feel in many ways there were elements of the carnival that needed to be rebranded, refocused, and I think it would have been really challenging to have done that anyway if it had just kept churning out as was year on, year off. But it remains a controversial topic. There are now two different separate groups trying to deliver a carnival, so we shall see what will happen.
We certainly will. And I mean, I wasn't totally surprised to see efforts to move the carnival in London after the Grenfell Tower. But you see, I think the locals feel like, well, it seems to be just an excuse to move it away from the scene of this devastation, from this atrocity. You know, yeah. people are, and actually they're saying, well, actually, we shouldn't be doing that because it's almost like we want to kind of look the other way.
Well, I think we've seen the great spirit of people power following that great disaster of Grenfell. And I think you've got some really strong characters in that area, some very strong activists. And I think people will... I mean, it's been, let's face it, the Conservative councillors and council who've wanted to shift the carnival anyway. Even before Grenfell, there was pressure. I believe some of the local councillors have now, well, the MPs and the council have changed, have swung more to Labour. But I think the pressure was there anyway. And I think now you've got very kind of hardcore grassroots activists who are really not going to be prepared to budget anywhere. It's more, no, we will be there. We will be showing our culture. We will be standing in unity. We will be displaying the best elements of our Black British culture.
It almost seems like a bit of a competition between bottom-up activity and top-down activity, where the powers that be, whether that is the police, the local Conservative council, and the new leader has also got into trouble this week for having a go at some of those who were survivors of Grenfell Tower. So she's not done very well, even though she's supposed to be some sort of wonderful replacement. And then we hear yesterday, angry Grenfell Tower residents demand arrests and resignations at a meeting. Kensington and Chelsea council meeting sees people express rage and contempt for officialdom and investigations slow progress. Are you surprised?
I'm not surprised. I think it's highly emotive. It is a major tragedy, a major incident that's happened, and a kind of symbolic sign of the times, really. And I think these processes can be frustratingly slow, and it's all the bureaucracy which makes it that way as well. I'm not surprised at people's anger and frustrations. And I think you're absolutely right that there's this kind of clash between, you know, top down and grassroots up. There doesn't seem to be a coming together. And we've also seen, you know, outrageous comments by a member of the Conservative Party this week. And you think, well, what is going on here? What are people actually thinking, doing, saying behind closed doors? It seems to be a huge gap between people at the minute. And I'm not quite sure how it's going to pan out.
Most of these meetings of the people down at Grenfell seem to turn to anger one way or another, or there was an attempt at some sort of silent vigil today. DCI Matt Bonner, who's leading the police investigation, struggled to reassure more than 200 people present at St Clement's Church that he would bring those responsible to justice. Mm-hmm. He told the meeting it was highly complex investigation, unprecedented, only to be told the fire was indeed a terrorist attack or mass murder. The investigation will hold people to account, Bonner insisted, almost inaudibly amidst the commotion. He was repeatedly asked why arrests had not already been made. Mm. I can't give you a commentary, he said. It would risk jeopardising the investigation and losing prosecutions down the line. Every single question you ask will be answered. Bonner said a team of about 250 officers was working on the criminal investigation. And I'll bring you in here now, Martin Summers. The locals are saying that if you haven't arrested, I mean, at least arrest people and interview them. You haven't arrested anybody yet.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's obviously hard to second-guess a police investigation, but the suspicion has got to be... I mean, how long did it take for Hillsborough to finally come to trial? 40, you know, decades. And I'm sure people won't be willing to accept that in this case.
No, and it's the same. If we wouldn't have even got the Hillsborough verdict or justice, in a sense, had not had the families not pursued it for so long.
Well, we actually still don't have justice for Hillsborough. There have been charges, but still, nobody's actually been jailed for it. The police now who have been charged finally, and talking of which, police officer has been charged with assault over tasering of Judah Adumbi in the face. Mm-hmm. She will appear before magistrates in August after the incident in Bristol. So, I mean, at least it does look as if there is some sort of equality under the law here in the South West.
Well, that's
maybe.
It. As you may be aware, I'm part of that campaign, Justice for Jude. I've been supporting him since the incident. And it is rather significant, actually, to have this referred to the CPS. So in some ways, it is a victory for the campaign because very few cases go to, well, are referred, let alone accepted by the CPS. What happens after that will remain to be seen, but I think it does send a message out. Unfortunately, we haven't got, we're still not in a position where we can see the IPCC investigation, which has been completed. But yeah, it is progress, and we keenly await to see what will happen. But again, it could take a matter of a month, or it could be 6 months to actually wait for the verdict of the for the trial to go on.
Martin, I think that one of the things that annoys people so much is that there is this impression, whether it's true or not, I'll leave to you, of impunity for people who are rich and powerful, maybe members of the House of Lords, sons and daughters of members of the House of Lords. They're above the law.
Well, I think if you look at what happened during the banking crisis, what should have happened is people should have been prosecuted. In the 1980s, when the savings and loans system in the US collapsed,
by the way, just had the chief executive of Barclays has just been charged.
Well, indeed, but it's years later.
But only because of his links to Qatar.
Well, that's right. It's years later. And in fact, there's a guy called James Galbraith, who's the son of the economist John Kenneth Galbraith. He's based in Texas, I believe. And he's an expert on all of this, and he's saying the only way that you can actually clean up the financial system if senior players are sent to prison, because they're not deterred by any kind of fines. The fines are no deterrent of any kind, because it's just the cost of doing business.
They don't even pay the fine, do they? In fact,
their organisations that pay
as
the fine.
As a bank,
that's right.
They go into one of their offices, they press a button, they make the money up out of nowhere and pay the fine like that. That's not really punishing anybody.
I mean, we have just seen a Viscount, though, haven't we? Been sent to jail for only, I think it's only 12 weeks. The person who was, proven to have, to put some awful comments on social media, but planned to kind of get Gina Miller run over. So, you know, that's one Viscount who is falling.
Yeah, maybe this is a beginning of the crumbling of this whole thing of impunity. Who knows? Because documents from June and July 2014, which the Times published, show that Grenfell Tower refurbishment consultants Artelia UK were pressured to reduce costs. An urgent nudge email about cladding prices from Kensington and Chelsea's tenant management organisation to Artelia says, "We need good costs for Councillor Fielding Mellon and the planner tomorrow at 8:45 a.m. with a big exclamation mark. Now, when you say something like that, we need good costs for Councillor Fielding Mellon, it does. You could get the impression that he's trying to drive costs down, Martin. And this is seen by some as a great accolade to somebody, that they can drive the costs down. And almost you get a slap in the back and a promotion if you can do it.
Well, I think the whole chain of subcontracting in this particular case is the fundamental problem. Back in the day, the Kensington and Chelsea Council would have had its own people to fix everything to do with this. There would have been a direct labour organisation. They would have decided how much they wanted to spend. They would have spent it. And, of course, what the Tories have done over many years is push this idea that keeping costs down is the be-all and end-all. And, of course, that they've been pushing this idea of deregulation, bonfire of regulations, as some of them so unwisely have called it. And, of course, that's why you end up with this kind of mess. And at the end of the day, it's a false economy. You've got to decide on the quality of what you want, and then the cost of that has got to be costed, not decide how we can get it done at the cheapest possible price. That's a recipe for disaster.
It almost seems like the more there are in the chain, Cleo, say, whether it's the council, whether it's a subcontractor, whether it's these guys who were the consultants for the refurbishment, you're always pointing the finger at somebody else and saying, well, it's nothing to do with me.
That's it, and I take Martin's point that, you know, surely, in most areas of life and business, you quote for a job and then you know, with some kind of hard facts about how much it might cost, and look for alternative quotes. But yeah, I agree. It's been passed on and passed on and passed on, and it's absolutely disgusting. It is again profit over people.
Well, all the folks, the thousands of people around Ladbroke Grove and in the Grenfell Tower area, are demanding some arrests. They're saying, well, we're not just going to let the police get away with pretending to do an investigation, and when they come across powerful people that might have made money out of this and be responsible for cost cutting that's led to those black block of flats being turned into a death trap, that they're not just going to let it lie. And of course, this is there is a parallel in a way with this kind of inquiry that's being launched, supposedly, although it doesn't look as if the locals are happy with that either. I mean, what disgusts me, and maybe you can just reflect on this as well, Cleo, is that it's a horrific tragedy, just as something like 7/7 was. One is an accident, the other one deliberate by somebody. But it almost seems as if immediately people are having to then suffer again and again and again, whether it be through being given derisory offers of alternative housing by Kensington and Chelsea Council, or just simply by being asked to sign a waiver so that you cannot, you know, here's some money, you're in shock, here's a bit of money, but by the way, the one of the dotted lines in the small print says you will never be able to sue us again in the future.
It's wholly inadequate and absolutely horrendous, and it's very hard to comprehend, really. It just shows that how people are marginalised, and again, it kind of feeds into the fear of gentrification. It's unlikely that many of these people will be able to be housed locally in their communities, which is going to add to the trauma. Some people have been offered accommodation in Preston, you know, so it's kind of like, well, that, and there's documents circling to say that there were plans anyway to demolish in that area. And I know people from the Westway project who have been clinging on to community centres and nurseries and, you know, being quite vocal about it, that there's the big sell-off of community assets, and people are being pinched, and if you don't fit to people's standards, if you haven't got the money in the bank and et cetera, then you're getting pushed out.
Yeah, it's. I think what the incident itself has brought home the inadequacy of housing policy to court. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, when that building went up in the 1970s, there was still a commitment to having mixed-use communities with wealthy people living on the same streets as poorer people, and that was the way that Britain ran. Mm. And we've gradually destroyed that step by step over decades, and we're moving to a US-style system where, you know, the poor in Los Angeles live kilometres away from the wealthy. Well, and that's not really the British way, or it wasn't traditionally.
I suppose what I'm saying here is justice going to be done? Looks like no, it's not going to be done. And of course, this is rubbing salt into the wounds for people living around Ladbroke Grove. There is very little coverage of it, but I managed to grab a bit of audio of some of the victims of the 7/7 London bombings at the end of the inquest. People were hoping that they would have their questions answered, that they would be able to speak at the inquest, that the survivors and the victims' families found that they weren't. So let's just have a listen now to some of the people speaking after the end of the inquest into the 7/7 London bombings.
We have questions that need answering. We were allowed to submit some questions to the Intelligence and Security Committee, but those questions were not answered. Our role now will be one of answering questions only, which we will do willingly, but our questions are not going to be answered. Again, we've been shunted aside by officialdom. It's very important that we all remember that the inquests are for the families and the loved ones of those who died. But this is our only voice. We've been led to believe that this would be an opportunity for us to have a voice, and now we don't.
Pretty horrific, Martin, that even after going through this public inquiry, the lady there who lost, I think it was either her sister or her daughter in the 7/7 bombings, just found that the inquiry didn't really help.
Well, there's a big question mark over inquiries in this country in general since the 2005 Inquiries Act, which basically allows the government to control the the basic outline of the inquiry. Inquiries, in theory, traditionally used to be run by the judiciary, but the 2005 Act has certainly tightened that up. And there was always a question mark about whether these inquiries were genuine and independent anyway. I mean, the first inquiry into Bloody Sunday was a whitewash, and then they had to have another one because the first one was not adequate. And I'm afraid British inquiries have got a reputation around the world for being obfuscation and basically trying to hide the truth.
So what do you make of that? It's pretty harrowing audio, actually, isn't it? Listening to someone who's been promised that this is going to be their opportunity to ask questions of the people who allowed the 7/7 bombings to take place. Of course, they lied. MI5 lied. They said initially that the bombers were all clean skins, and during the during the inquest and during other trials, it came out that actually they had massive files on them. We've been following them for years. Those sort of lies can really hurt. Now, I'm not saying this is going to be quite the same secrecy in the Grenfell thing, but it doesn't really bode well, does it?
No, it doesn't. And there's a lot of scepticism. Obviously, there's a backlash against the judge who's been chosen to head this inquiry or whatever. And
for good reason, because he was actually involved in a case saying that it was okay for not quite. I was going to use the word deport one of the people who lived in Kensington and Chelsea out of the borough, out of London, even, I think, up to Milton Keynes. So that was okay, you know. So we can rehouse you in Milton Keynes, and that's fine. This judge said. Now, of course, this is like a red rag to a bull to people who live around there.
Mm. Yeah, it is, and I think communication lines are very important. From what I can tell, at arm's length, looking through the media and social media, and I do follow some of the community activists and leaders down there, such as Ishmael Blagrove, who's also calling for calm, that the response has been very slow, and even now the communication lines between the council and the people on the ground just aren't very good.
And I've seen actually some good and some not so good, but actually it's almost like the London media TV people at Channel 4 and Newsnight have almost woken up out of their slumber, having occasionally a few good programmes, actually getting some ordinary people on talking about what's been going on for the first time for years. I was watching something a bit earlier on this week which was a bit like that. Anyhow, moving on to some other stories. Mayor Marvin Rees has been warning Bristol will have to choose what to cut as well as what to save. The Mayor of Bristol has asked the people of Bristol this. Martin, what do you make of this? He's actually in the past said, what are the most important things that you want to keep? He's now saying, what do you want to cut? Because we're going to have to cut quite a lot.
Well, it's a very difficult position to be in, isn't it? There's some suggestion that Labour core cities should refuse to set a budget and therefore refuse to carry through the cuts. I don't think that there's any stomach for that.
Well, I don't know if that's what do you think, Cleo? What's the general feeling? Is Marvin standing up to Westminster and banging his fist enough, making enough fuss about all this?
As a Green Party, we've put in numerous questions and requests at full council, etc., made some appeals to ask that we would like more of a as you say, standing up to Westminster. And I think it's the great fear that if you don't conform, if you like, that you'll get Westminster coming down and imposing a budget on you. And I think, well, you know, it's a possibility, it's not a given. And of course, you know, there's Bristol People's Assembly who will be lodging a lobby, will be lobbying next week at full council, calling on Marvin again to link up with the core cities. I mean, let's face it, all of our core cities, bar I think one, they're all Labour-led. But what does it mean to be Labour-led when we're still having to push through austerity? You know, that's the horrible irony of it all. It's, people celebrate that we've got four Labour MPs now, we're a red city. But what does it mean when we're still closing libraries and parks? And in Britain, which is still meant to be one of the richest countries, we haven't got the basics. It's not on.
Well, it is. It's the seventh richest country in the world, Martin.
Well, that's right. And I think the problem is that this is a deliberate ploy by the Conservative government. They've loaded most of the cuts onto local government because they don't control local government.
But Labour are going along with it willingly, aren't they?
Well, they're not going along with it willingly, Tony. They're going along with it because there isn't the option of not going along with it and refusing to set a budget is not really there if you unless you've prepared people in advance. In Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin, at one stage, were planning not to go into the Assembly, and they were going to boycott the Assembly because they weren't going to carry out budget cuts. cuts. What's happened now, because the DUP have been bribed to prop up the government, is that there won't be such bad cuts going on in Northern Ireland, so therefore Sinn Féin can't refuse to participate in the cuts because there isn't going to be the same level of cuts. But of course, what's going on in Belfast, they need their libraries and schools and hospitals properly funded and all the rest of it, same as the rest of us. But for political reasons, they're going to be given cut some slack, but we're not. But ultimately, I think people can see what's going on here. We need a change of government. This tired old clapped out government has got to go, and it's only been there for, you know, for a few weeks, but it's already on
Cleo,
its last legs.
What Marvin is saying, that he's got £104 million worth of cuts the city council's got to make in the next 5 years, and also that he's having to do the cuts that the previous mayor George Ferguson managed to wriggle out of.
I mean, I suppose that is an element of it, and when we had our budget full council and leading up to that, it did come more to light about the amount of savings that were not made over the last administration, so it has made it even more challenging. And part of the situation is of whatever you want to call it, inefficiencies or the previous administration not cutting. So
people will say well, George Ferguson managed to wangle it so that he managed to make sure that we didn't get the cuts
on his watch. It wasn't on his shoulders.
And Marvin is saying, well, that means I'm going to have to cut double.
Yeah, exactly. That's the reality of it.
But why can't Marvin wangle it, Martin?
Well, he's got the option, I suppose, but I guess it's not the responsible thing to do, in his opinion.
No, but it's saving services. Martin, why can't Marvin do this? You're a member of the Labour Party.
No, well, the fact is, as has been pointed out, if you set an illegal budget, they will just send in...
Not saying that. George didn't do that, did he?
No, George didn't do that because the screw hadn't tightened. You can keep putting it off. It's like those red letters dropping through the letterbox. George was in the lucky position. He could carry on putting them behind the clock and
ignoring
them. Why
can't Marvin put it off too?
Because it's all
He's
piled up.
He's got masses of reserves, by the way.
Yeah, but all right, the reserves. You could use the reserves. You could only use them once. Even if you use them,
there are two potential tactics we're talking about here. One is getting together with the other core cities and making a consolidated millions of people protesting against what is happening with central government. He's not doing that. The other one is using reserves and wangling the figures like George did, and he's not doing that either. So what is he doing?
Well, when we knocked on doors to elect Marvin a couple of years ago, we didn't say to people, vote for us and we will defy the government and set an illegal budget. And in fact, some people did stand and say they would do that.
Nobody suggested...
Stood in the election...
I didn't suggest that, did I? I suggested two other things. Why isn't he doing those?
Because you can only use the reserves once, and the reserves are there, for example, if there's a major flood or a fire or something, you might need those reserves. And secondly, ultimately, you can get together with the other core cities, and it may be if the government is wobbling, all core cities could just give them a push at the last minute. The real thing we've got to do is get the government changed.
Okay, so he's keeping...
That's what we've got to do.
Keeping his powder dry,
that's right.
Just waiting for the right opportunity over the next 5 years. Meanwhile, cutting.
Well, that's because people aren't ready to fight yet, Tony. In Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland, led an armed struggle against the British state over 40 years.
There's not going to their be an
people
armed
are ready.
In Bristol.
No, there isn't.
There?
There isn't, Tony, and there isn't even going to be a defiance and refuse to pay council tax either.
You can't compare it
no,
to
you
the
can't
armed
compare
struggle
it.
In Northern
you
Ireland.
You can't compare it. That's quite right. You can't compare it.
I mean, I think that's right. I think people have become dumbed down to a certain extent. Bristol has historically been a city that stands up, but for whatever reason, well, people are trying, but... you know, I think, well, something has to be done. And I think the threat of civil unrest, I mean, we've yet to see the consultation results, etc., of council tax reduction scheme. So a lot of people are going to get hit who've maybe never paid council tax, and now they're going to have to, because this always is something that is an option. People think it's like housing benefit, but it's not. It's a choice that the city council makes to support the most vulnerable in our society. But that is about to change.
In Northern Ireland, they still have the rates system. Because they were unable to impose council tax and poll tax, because it would have just been pouring petrol on the bonfire.
We discussed
but that means, of course, that local government in Northern Ireland is better funded.
Mm.
Anyway, Prime Minister's questions. We're talking about Westminster and as well as the City Hall here. There was no Theresa May, and Damian Green explained why.
Mr. Speaker, I've been asked to reply. My right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, is in attendance on Her Majesty the Queen, welcoming Their Majesties King Felipe and Queen Letizia of Spain on their state visit to the United Kingdom. I'm sure the whole House wishes them well.
So Theresa May has been busy with the Queen of Spain. So she can't do Prime Minister's questions this week.
Oh. Very interesting, especially as especially as I've recently come back from a trip to Trinidad. I thought I'd shoehorn that in, talking about the removal of Christopher Columbus's statue. So it seems very apt.
But she's busy chatting with the Spanish, and so she can't come to answer questions. Also, another, I think, fascinating little tidbit this week, the lady vanishes, and this came up at Prime Minister's questions too.
Jamie Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Politicians are said to be here today and gone tomorrow, but whatever tomorrow may bring, the Prime Minister isn't even here today to mark the end of her first year in power. And I note for the first time since she's become Prime Minister that listen, you might like to hear this. For the first time since she's become Prime Minister, her image has now been removed from the front page of the Conservative Party website. So... Can the First Secretary tell us why she has gone from being the next Iron Lady to the Lady Vanishes?
The Honourable Gentleman is ingenious in asking very personal questions, and I commend him for it. Unfortunately, he has got his own record on this subject. As recently as June last year, the Honourable Gentleman said that the leader of the Labour Party is not destined to become Prime Minister, and he called on him to resign. I suggest he might want to make peace with his own front bench before he starts being rude about ours.
Well, quite a jokey question, Cleo, but there does seem to be, you know, no Theresa May, no Prime Minister at Prime Minister's questions. She's disappeared off the Tory website. Has she lost her political authority? What's going on?
Well, it still feels like, however inadequate she is, she's still there. So, you know, she can be as inadequate as she likes and not show up and things, but until she's actually ousted by her own party or something else happens, then what's going on?
It's almost like, Martin, that the Prime Minister's afraid to show her face anymore.
Well, I think that's obviously the implication. I mean, that she's, you know, as George Osborne said, she's a dead woman walking. But we don't need the Tory party to replace her with some other basically waste of space person. We need this government to fall as rapidly as possible. And I think the DUP might be able to play a role in this, because in actual fact, many of the things they want are actually more in line with what the rest of the country wants than it is with the Tory party. I think they've been bribed with this whole thing of extra spending for Northern Ireland. But that, of course, bound to raise the question. I mean, the DUP have also supported public sector pay being frozen. And, you know, why should a nurse working in Birmingham feel very pleased about the DUP getting extra money for Belfast when they're voting to keep nurses' wages down? And the DUP, if they've got a future in British politics, have got to realise that the Tories are not necessarily their best friends, and that the relationship is actually rather an abusive one.
Well, and up against Theresa May, Damien Green this week, was Emily Thornberry for Labour. She was going on about Brexit again. What are your thoughts about Brexit, Cleo? Do you think it's going to happen? Is it a good thing, a bad thing?
I think everything's pointing towards it happening. And I don't think it's a very good thing at all, no.
Why not?
I can't really see much of the there isn't many positive angles coming from it. It's very uncertain, and we've already are experiencing European people leaving because they feel unwelcome. There's been a rise in hate crime. There's a lot of
hang
ignorance.
On though, because there's actually been a lot more people coming to Britain thinking, well, I want to get in before Brexit and then I can stay.
You know, really?
So, yes, there's something like 200,000 extra
okay. In
the last 12 months. So, I mean, I don't know. We were talking to former Tory MEP Richard Cottrell last week, and he said, well, he lives in Italy and he's got a certificate saying he and his wife and his kids, whatever, can stay as long as they want.
Oh, that's nice for him.
And it'd be, I think, the same over here. I mean, that's what the government has set out. As I said, people who are already here can stay.
Right.
And the same with Brits who are living in other parts of the European Union. Martin, what do you make of it all?
Well, it's a train crash. It's watching a train crash in slow motion. It's going to take years. I mean, it seems that it's set now because of this referendum, which happened once.
Are you one of these Remainiacs that wants another?
No, I'm just pointing out that referendums were held frequently in Northern Ireland, and if they didn't get the right result, they were ignored. So, for example, there was a referendum on whether they should be joining the Republic or not.
Well,
and
if you're ignoring referendums, you're in a dictatorship, aren't
you? Well, no, you're not, because referendums can be... In actual fact, the British Constitution is clear. Parliament is sovereign. And if Parliament decided not to do Brexit, the referendum would be overturned, according to the British Constitution. Now, you have decided, or Brexiteers have decided, that the referendum becomes overwhelming on the politicians, but that's not the British Constitution. If you actually look at the British Constitution, unwritten Constitution, Parliament is sovereign. So it's always up to Parliament to decide in the end what it wants to do. And the referendum is in effect advisory. And don't forget, in the six counties of Northern Ireland and in Scotland, people voted to remain. And that, of course, then questions whether the United Kingdom is going to remain.
Well, that happens always in any kind of vote, doesn't it? I mean, you know, you're always going to get some parts that are more...
Well, don't forget, Martin,
you always get some parts that are more in favour of one thing than another. In a general election, it's exactly the same. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean to say that we split the country up into all the various different constituencies mm-hmm. and they all run themselves, although that might actually work.
Well, I mean, in Ireland in particular, that's a very questionable...
It would certainly separate the cities from the... country, wouldn't it? I mean, if you were to do that, following your argument. Anyway, Cleo, do you think where are we going to be in 2 years' time? Do you think
where are we going to be in 2 years' time? Well, we'll still be in Europe, I'd imagine.
Well, we'll certainly be in Europe. What about the EU, though?
Well, that's what I mean. I think we'll still be in the EU.
Because people talk about the two together, don't they? We're definitely not leaving Europe. Europe is a continent, right? We're not going... It's not going to be some sort of jetpack put on Britain and us go off out into the Atlantic and join up with the United States, although that might happen metaphorically. You reckon we'll still be in the EU?
I don't know. I mean, on a more local level, connects to what you were just talking about, we still don't really know how devolution and our metro mayor, how that's going to impact on us, because that has brought rural areas and cities together, hasn't it?
Well, it certainly has. It's almost as if the boundary of Bristol was spread about 30 miles out so that we could become a Conservative city and it to include all those Conservative voters. It almost looked like that was done by design. Anyway, let's have another listen to some of the Prime Minister's questions this week, and something that affects us all, which is increasing electricity bills, especially these kind of oligopolistic, monopoly, privatised electricity firms. As a question asked by Caroline Flint about the National Grid, who are doing really, really well.
Yeah. Yeah. Caroline Flint.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Isn't today's report that National Grid made £3 billion profit in 2015-16 at the expense of households further evidence that the government is not delivering fair energy prices? Will the government agree to an immediate rebate for overcharging, and will the government now commit to an energy price cap for the 70 million households on the most expensive tariffs? Yeah.
The Right Honourable Lady is right to identify the issue of energy prices, and I'm sure she will welcome the announcement in the Queen's speech that the government will ensure fairer markets for consumers, and that this will include bringing forward measures to help tackle unfair practices in the energy market to help reduce energy bills. I'm sure this is an issue on which we can work across the House together.
So, £7.5 billion, the energy network, the National Grid, Martin, made last year. That's very nice for its shareholders.
Well, that's right. I mean, the energy industry should never have been privatised. Never. It was run effectively by the government in such a way that they provided energy at cost to business and households, and any extra profit generated was reinvested in the system. The creation of a so-called energy market is delusionary. You haven't really got competition between these oligopolistic companies. And, of course, Theresa May was talking about having an energy cap, which, of course, she stole from Ed Miliband's proposals at the last election. But now she can't actually do it because her Tory right-wing friends won't allow her to do it. So we're just going to carry on being screwed. That's what's going to happen.
Cleo, this is worrying because since privatisation of electricity and utilities generally, if you or I have got, say, £12,000, £15,000 to invest, as many people have out there, not us, but a lot of people do, if they were to invest them in those firms like the National Grid, like the individual energy companies, they never have to pay an electricity bill again because they get a dividend on those shares, which pays the electricity bill for them. And not only that, they get a big increase in their investment. So there are the rich who are getting free electricity while the poor who are on meters are getting cut off and paying probably two or three times what they should be.
Well, yeah, that's the nature of how this system works, though, isn't it? And I think obviously being a green, we look into renewables, we look at the way forward, and we are seeing more solar energy, etc., to make the, you know, use of fossil fuels be the faster that it is, really. So, I think it's shocking, again, that people, citizens, human beings in Great Britain, so-called Great Britain, are going to be struggling to even have the basics in life. It's just absolutely ludicrous.
Martin, you've looked at this. I mean, you've been looking at this energy market and the whole thing of privatisation for years. But in a way, this is similar to what happened with Grenfell, isn't it? It's about the government ceding its decision making to private businesses.
It is, and of course, it has implications, because the profiteering by these monopolistic companies undermines the position of British businesses, which are trying to export into the international market. They are basically handicapped, and this is the problem with Britain all over, with too much rent seeking, too many people trying to make money out of monopolistic.
Sorry, what do you mean by rent seeking?
Well, rent seeking can be either people basically owning land, and therefore, you know, you've got to pay them to use the land, and they just inherited it, basically.
What, I mean, like people that own properties in Spain or something?
Well, no, I'm talking about the people that, if, as you know, we had Kevin Cahill frequently on this show, who's written the book Who Owns Britain, and nobody should be surprised to learn that the families that own Britain are the same families that owned it in 1066, and those people get free money from the rest of society because their families own the land. The Duke of Westminster owns central London, so he just gets loads of free money as the property market goes up. Mm. Now, what you should do is you shouldn't.
And by the way, the Duke of Westminster's father supported Hitler in the 1930s,
well, indeed,
all the way
indeed.
Through.
You know, that's another level again, isn't it? And of course, there's other kinds of rent seeking as well. There is no real competition between the energy companies. They collude with each other on things like confusion marketing and so on. And it's because to have a competitive market, you need hundreds of suppliers. And what they've done is they've created the pretense of a competitive market, both in the electricity industry, the water industry, and then the railway industry. These were all nationalised in the 1940s because they're natural monopolies.
And one of the things that
that's why they were nationalised in the first place.
The Department of Energy and the energy companies, the only time you'll probably have heard from your energy company is for them phoning you up, telling you, oh, you need a smart meter. I got a call the other day saying, oh, I just thought I'd let you know that your meter is coming to the end of its life and it's time to replace it. And I just put the phone down, because these smart meters, I think you could almost say for smart read stupid. It's very Orwellian. I just done a little compilation the other day of some of the articles about smart meters. SSE customers were billed, and I'll put some links up on our show page. I'll take great pleasure in doing this, at thisweek.org.uk. Shocked SSE customers billed £33,000 for one day's gas after a smart meter error. The energy giant were forced to apologise after a number of their devices malfunctioned, quoting thousands of pounds for one day of gas and electricity. Well, tens of thousands of pounds for one day's gas or electricity. So that's one story, the Daily Record in Scotland. One in five households don't want a smart meter, and millions worry they could lead to a cyber security breach. Well, that's very sensible, folks, because they could lead to a cyber security breach. Customers are worried about the way the data is collected with a smart meter. They're meant to help consumers save money, but they don't. And government has a target of 2020 for installing smart meters in UK homes. It's not going to hit that target. One of the stupid things about the smart meters is, of course, that the energy companies spending all this money on them are having to put their bills up as a result. And they're supposed to save you money.
Well, yeah.
Have you got a smart meter?
I don't have a smart meter yet, and it hasn't been pushed on me as yet. But I am aware of various schemes that I've heard of in around St. Paul's area that are going to be coming in using the smart meters and other with incentives for different appliances that are energy efficient and blah, blah, blah. It all sounds very good on the surface. But I think, you know, I'm actually going to have to leave in a second. But I just think, you know, reflecting back on what's just been said, the audacity and history of people to take land, and we think about land ownership as such a serious issue, that the people really need to have that same audacity that these elite people had and have, you know, that we do have a human right, a universal right, that should go beyond, that we should have, and we shouldn't be on our knees begging all the time to have the basics in life, and that we really need to find the strength and the audacity to take what should belong to us. And I'm tired of it, and I think it's absolutely outrageous that wherever in the world, and yeah, I'm looking into different elements of world history, that people can just plod onto people's land and say, right, it's mine now, and we're still suffering the consequences of that. So I feel that we're coming to a crossroads of humanity, and it's time that we all spoke up and did what we can, and I absolutely agree, we desperately need a change of government to be able to facilitate that.
Well, just on what you're saying there, Article 25 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, signed after World War II and all the carnage of that, says that everybody has the right to shelter. Now, why have we got people sleeping on the streets in Bristol and other cities in Britain, in the seventh richest country in the world?
That's right. And my gut feeling is, you know, when you look in and see about how, you know, maybe the feudal system or other systems where people were taken from the country, encouraged or forced to come into the cities and work and blah, 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 I feel that it's only a matter of time before poorer people within cities are going to start being kicked out back to the country. And I think, well, they'll just make a success of it, and then people will come back into the country, and do you know what I mean? And so it goes on. So, you know, we shall see, but let's try to stay optimistic and positive, as difficult as it is.
Well, thanks very much, Cleo Lake, Green Councillor for Cotton, for joining us. I know you've got a dash now. Thank you very much. Martin, another aspect of these smart meters is that the government is simply not going to hit any of its targets. It's supposed to be trying to get them in by 2020, but it's not going to happen. The other thing is that it means your electricity can be cut off remotely.
Well, indeed. It's a kind of a matrix of control in which people are going to be trapped, isn't it? There's also talk around the world of getting rid of cash, as they've tried to do in India in recent months, which I find absolutely extraordinary when you think about a country like India, where people basically have been a cash-in-hand economy for most people, or even just a barter economy. How can you talk about getting rid of cash? But all of this is to create a situation where we really are under the thumb, where you know, if you want to buy something, you've got to show a credit card or a chip or something, and you know, the population becomes surveillable by the state and others forces around the state.
Or behind it. Also, my smart meter is so dumb, I have to press 7 buttons to get a reading. The news from abroad is also worrying. A Dutch study of smart meters found 5 different models produce erroneous readings, sometimes 6 times higher than the actual energy consumption using green energy-saving equipment such as LED light bulbs. So they're not even giving correct readings as to the amount of electricity you're using. They're 6 times higher, these particular ones.
Well, obviously the technology isn't entirely bug-free, but in any case, it can be hacked. All of these things can be hacked. And that's, again, as another vulnerability.
So does that mean we can hack our own smart meters and cut our bills?
Well, possibly people could do that, but that just goes to show how ill thought out the whole thing is, doesn't it?
Amazing. Yep, it certainly does. So also, Prime Minister's questions this week, Martin, finally. There was a question about the high employment.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Today's jobs figures show that we have the highest employment rate since comparable records began. We have more people in full-time employment, yep, and we are touching on the lowest youth unemployment since records began.
Yeah.
In light of the Matthew Taylor Review and the modern working practices, what more can be done to ensure that this record continues and that low youth unemployment continues and we rid this country of that scourge?
Yeah. My honourable friend is exactly right, specifically on the subject of youth unemployment.
Well, I'm not going to listen to the rest of that because it's a Conservative asking a Conservative a nice soft question. But, Martin, these figures look good, though, don't they?
Ostensibly, yes. But don't forget, we've had zero interest rates and quantitative easing for 8 years. That's not normal. And, of course, at some point, interest rates are going to rise, the property market's going to crash and everybody's going to be on the dole.
Have you seen the amount that the self-employed, average self-employed wages for the year have gone down massively? 10 years ago, to be a self-employed person selling things on eBay. Anyway, time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guest, Green Councillor for Cotton, Cleo Lake. After the Murdoch News, leadership charities.
Still bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.